is a fascinating subject that connected to the sukkah and sukkahs. And if we understand correctly, will give us a new perspective on life and Torah, and also take us through a lot of the wonderful Torah involved in the problems of astrology and divination, certain thoughts of the question of idolatry. Looking sukkah, the Gemara says like this. The Gemara sukkah talks like this. In the fifth parak, when it talks about the Simchas Beis HaSheva, the Simcha of Sukkot, the climax of Sukkot, when the Jewish people got together in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. Not far from here, just a few hundred meters from here. Today what lies in ruins then was the site of a very amazing experience. And the Gemara says it's worth learning through this Gemara, if you're able to, just to see the kind of things that happened over there. Example, the Gemara says like this. The Mishnah says, somebody who never saw that rejoicing, the rejoicing of the water drawing ceremony in the Beit HaMikdash, that person had never seen rejoicing. That means that unless you'd seen that happiness, you'd never seen happiness. It was such an incredible ecstatic experience that everything else fell into insignificance. What did they do? The Mishnah describes in detail what they used to do. They used to prepare lamps, oil lamps. And how many bowls or basins of olive oil or oil they used to put in. And ladders up to each one. They were like floodlights. And the young Kohanim, the children or the young Kohanim, they used to climb these ladders and they used to put in 120 lug of oil, a large amount of oil. And they used to put into wicks twisted out of the clothes of the Kohanim. And when they lit these, the lights are so bright, there were so many of these, the lights are so intense, that it says that not a single courtyard in Jerusalem wasn't lit by that light. A woman could sort barley grains, it says, by that light, anywhere in Jerusalem. And they used to start dancing, and they used to, used to juggle 8 flaming torches at the same time. They used to do acts. He used to stand on his thumb. That was the trick that he had to try sometimes. Try a thumb stand. Try stand on your thumbs. I don't know, I'm here. I don't want to have to set the bones. And it goes on about what they used to do. Now, at the heart of this procedure, the climax, the Mishnah ends with the following very strange statement, and that's what we'll have to try and understand. The Mishnah says like this, that they used to move, a procession moved in a certain place up the steps, 15 steps that they had from the Ezras Noshim, higher, and they used to stand and say the following thing. When they got to the gate that led out to the east, they used to say this. They turned their faces from the east to the west. Listen to this strange thing. They turned their faces from the east to the west, and they said the following statement. Our forefathers who were in this place, their backs were to the sanctuary in that direction, and their faces were to the east. In other words, to the sun. Used to bow down to the sun. Yes, that's what our forefathers were. Idolaters. Long before Abraham's time, the time of his parents, his father, they were idolaters. They used to bow down to the sun. But we, but our eyes are to Hashem. In other words, they're recounting here the pathway that led to this moment of climax to the Jewish people in the temple close to Hashem, the way it should be on Sukkot after Yom Kippur has wiped out all the avirus, all the spiritual blemish being taken away. And now this moment of closeness, so now we say we've reached this climax after starting from a place of impurity. It's our forefathers who are idolaters. They worship the sun, it's to bow down to the sun. But we've come a long way since then. That means Abraham, Avram Avinu, the Jewish people receiving the Torah, we've come to this place now where our eyes are turned towards you. First question, of course, is this has to be done on Sukkot. This is the this is the climax of Sukkot, at the pinnacle of the happiness of the water drawing ceremony. This is a declaration that has to be made. But what's even more strange is this: it continues to say that Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Rabbi Yehuda says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Hayushenim Vayim, they would say twice, Anu Lekar, we are towards to Hashem, Ulekar Enen, and our eyes, and towards Hashem our eyes are turned. Now this defies understanding. What exactly is this argument? We know, yes, all of you with any Gemara background know, that if it says Rabbi Yehuda Omer, it always means an argument, as opposed to Omer Rabbi Yehuda. You're familiar with that convention, right? Whenever there's an amplification or explanation, then it says Omer Rabbi Yehuda. But if it says Rabbi Yehuda Omer, the name first, the convention, it means it's an argument. Thank you. So, what is this argument? The Chachamim say that we stand and we say, we don't idolaters anymore. Our eyes are towards Hashem. Those are the words, Leka Enenu. You'd say that name of Hashem. We won't go into the mystical dimension of that name for the present time, but that name, towards Hashem, our eyes are turned. Not to the sun, but towards Hashem. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, but Rabbi Yehuda argues and says, Hayushenin Bo'emim, they would say it twice, like this, Anu Leka, we are towards Hashem, Uleka Enenu, and to Hashem our eyes are turned. Now what argument is it? What exactly? You hear the problem? You hear the problem? What's that issue here? What's going on? What's the name of the... What's the sugya? What is the argument about? What's important if you say that we turn towards Hashem, or first you say we turn to Hashem and our eyes are to Him, or our eyes are to Him? What exactly? So let's see if we can try and understand some basic ideas in the spiritual world, spiritual path, that might make this a bit clearer. Sukkot is a time, really, of absolute closeness to Hashem. That's what it is. Actually, seriously, the eighth day is a time of transcending completely. Sukkot, it says, the non-Jews also have a relationship to this holiday. It says that even in the next world, somehow, they'll also have a relationship to it. But the eighth day is when all the non-Jews leave and we're left alone with Hashem. This is a pinnacle of closeness to Hashem. Now, let's try and understand a theme that's very badly misunderstood usually, that can try and open up this, help us open up the subject. Let's look at it like this. You see, what's being pointed out here is the difference between Avodas Hashem, that means serving Hashem, closeness to the Creator, and the opposite, which is known as Avodah Zorah. Avodah Zorah, right? What you call in English idolatry, strange worship. Idol worship. We started as idolaters, and then we came right. It means we went through a phase of seeing our mistake and came right, which is what Sukkot is all about. Started in Rosh Hashanah, went through the breakdown process of working on our virus, and corrected it by Yom Kippur, so we can come to Sukkot as complete Baal HaTshuva. In fact, the rest of this chapter talks about how the Baal HaTshuva used to dance in a special circle of their own in the Beis HaMikdash. Actually, the Shem Shmuel says that Sukkot really is only needed for the Baal HaTshuva. The person who never sinned, the person who is perfect from the beginning, never needs a Sukkot. The person who needs to move into a Sukkot, that's the protection of the Sukkot, and that level, that's only a person who didn't live perfectly, made mistakes in his life and corrected them. He lived in an animal zone, and then he became human, became spiritual. He's the person who needs the sukkah. But that's always the pathway. Through breakdown, illusion. First of all, an illusion of perfection. Then you realize what an illusion it was, and you come face to face with your own problems, your own deficiencies. And then breaking down shows you exactly where the problems were, and that helps you work on them. And only after the breakdown can you reach perfection. And sukkah is a time of perfection. Yom Kippur has done it, now you've reached the time of perfection. But this intermediate stage that's problematic, this false worship, this concept of idols, that needs explanation. Let's see if we can try and touch on that a little bit. On the subject, we'll just have time maybe to just begin the discussion, but let's see if we can try and pick out some central themes. The problem with understanding idolatry is that what exactly are these idols that people worship? You see, we have problems because today we have less of the drive to idolatry than there was before in the world. The Gemara says that there was a time, around the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, they exorcised from the human soul the desire to worship idols in the way that it had been before. There was a drive, like the drive to sensuality that men have for women. That kind of drive. There was that sort of drive to idolatry before. It had a tremendous power. And because of its danger, because people weren't coping with it, they blinded it, they weakened it, they
they excised it from the human soul. Today we don't have an innate desire to bow down to a piece of wood or an image. We have equivalence and we have what takes its place, we have but we don't have that desire anymore. But you have to understand that there was a time when people had a desire to worship idolatry. If we understand the series discussion correctly, we'll see where it lies today as well. But there was such a thing. Now what is this exactly? What is this? A desire to worship a graven image? We're not talking here about fools. Right? The Torah doesn't come to discount what's foolish. The Torah comes to discount that which makes plenty of sense but is wrong. What on earth is the way? Yes, how does a person understand somebody who takes, the Navi even mocks it at one point. He says that a person takes a tree, a log of wood. He cuts half the wood and uses it for firewood. The other half he carves an image. Some sort, and then he bows down to it and says, "You are my creator." How do you understand that? The Torah is not talking about psychotics. The Torah is talking about people who know what they're doing. That should have bothered you. Anybody who's ever looked into Torah, even in the most secular version imaginable, should have been bothered by the problem of idolatry. We're not talking here about... And let's talk about what we call primitives. Some primitive individual, he thinks that a shape that he makes out of a piece of wood is his creator. Take a person on earth that's as primitive as you care to name, if you regard those people as primitive, some South Sea Islanders, or whatever in your mind is primitive. So a person chips a shape out of a piece of rock, and then he thinks that's his creator, that if he does some sort of service to this image, it will give him what he needs. No matter how primitive you are, that doesn't make sense. Tell him more. If you think about it carefully, you'll see that the Torah talks about idolatry as if it's very real. Very real. The Torah describes idolatry in very real terms. The Torah says, for example, let's try and approach it systematically. We know that the biggest prohibition in the Torah is the prohibition of idol worship. You're aware, I'm sure, that false gods are the converse of the worship of Hashem, the true creator. The first mitzvah of the Torah, the first of the Ten Commandments, is Anochi Hashem Elokecha, right? Let's go to basics here. We know that when we stood at Sinai, we heard Hashem speaking two commandments. The other eight of the ten, we weren't able to hear ourselves. The voltage was too powerful. People couldn't hear it, as it says in Gemara Shabbos, it says that everybody died when Hashem spoke. The Jewish people died, they had to be revived. They heard Him speak again, they died again. They were revived again, and they said to Moshe Rabbeinu, "You hear the rest and tell us. We've heard enough to establish the credentials of the source. We can't go through this again, it's a very difficult experience. Therefore, we'll trust you. We'll hear it from you. We've heard enough to convince us, right? You tell us the rest." And mystically that means, not only what it means superficially, mystically it means that the first two actually contain everything else. We know that the first commandment, that is, I am Hashem, that is the mitzvah of Emunah, and all positive mitzvahs are contained in that mitzvah. The second, which is the converse, which is, Lo Yelecha, there should be no other gods before me, the converse of that positive statement is the root of all negative commands. Anytime you break a commandment, you transgress a negative command, the ultimate root command that you're transgressing is the command of having some God other than Hashem, because if it was your overall boss, you wouldn't be able to do this act of disobedience. Right? Anytime you observe a positive mitzvah, so you are also observing the mitzvah of Emunah and Hashem, because you are acting out what He wishes. Obedience to His will. But anytime you break His will, so you are showing that He's not the boss. You are transgressing the prohibition of having something else as the boss. Right? So the two root zones, the two roots of all mitzvahs in the Torah are the positive mitzvah of Hashem being Hashem, and the negative version of that, of there being no other, nothing else. Those are the two roots. Now, you see that the root of all transgression, the root of all avarice in the Torah, is phrased as there should be no other gods before me. The prohibition of idolatry is the one that subsumes all others. That takes understanding. We're used to thinking that idolatry is some psychotic phenomenon. It's a ridiculous individual who gets seized by some crazy, right, inexplicable desire to make a shape on a piece of paper or carve something out of a piece of wood, or chip a shape of a face in a rock surface, and then that's what we think. But you see that it's not some peripheral psychotic phenomenon. You see that it's the root of all prohibitions in the Torah. Now that takes understanding. Why is the Torah so concerned that it makes as its root prohibition, it makes the problem of worshipping something that's stupid, something ridiculous, something that doesn't exist, something that's a figment of the imagination? Surely the Torah, have I made the point clear? Surely the Torah's main prohibition has to be against something very, very dangerous, something very, very real, something so close to reality that a person who's really trying could easily make that mistake. Surely the Torah doesn't phrase as its major prohibition that everything else depends on some absolutely ridiculous behavior that only a questionably insane individual would do. To make matters worse, there are many psukim in the Torah, there are many verses in the Torah that talk about idolatry as if it's very real indeed. The Torah talks about other gods as if they exist. Where do you see it? You see it in Shacharis every morning. We say, Ki kol Elohei ha'amim elilim, because all the gods of the nations are false gods, or little gods, or diminutive gods. And then you pause, because you can't say Hashem's name in the same breath. You have to pause. You see, most Siddurim, it actually says pause, or it has a line. And then you say, V'Hashem Shamayim also, but Hashem made the heavens. Listen to that statement. All the gods of the nations are little gods. Ki kol Elohei ha'amim, because all the gods of the nations, talks about gods of the nations. And it doesn't say they are figments of the imagination and ridiculous, you know, fantasies of a perturbed mind. It doesn't say that. It says all the gods of the nations are, well, they're sort of small gods. Elil means, it's a diminutive form in Hebrew. Kael, Aleph Lamed is Hashem's name. Elil is, in Hebrew, when you make a diminutive, you double the last letter like that. It means it's like a small god. It doesn't say they don't exist. So they're not so powerful. But the prophet says they exist. And not only that, but the mystics say that if you note carefully, the word that's used for these false gods is the same word we use for Hashem. It doesn't say, in English you use the word idol, an idol. But in Hebrew it doesn't do that. In the Torah, when the Torah speaks about these idols, these false gods, the Torah talks about, it uses the word that we use for Hashem. It says, Ki kol Elohei, you hear that word? Ha'amim. Because all the gods, we're only allowed to say that word when we're referring to a profane source. When we're talking about Hashem, we have to say, we say Elohim, we change the word, because we can't say that word of holiness. Yes, unless we're saying a full verse or in reading the Torah, let's say. But when we're talking about false gods, we say that word in its profane form, but the word is the same word. The Torah couldn't come up with another word. When the Torah wants to talk about false gods, it does them the honor of using the same grammar, the same word that it uses for Hashem. Can you hear the problem? I mean, if anything should have had a radically different word, it should have been the opposite of reality. The word for Hashem should have been the words that we use for Hashem, all the names of Hashem. And when we want to refer to false gods, we should have a word that's radically opposite, not the same name. And not only that name, there are many other times we use psukim. That, is this only a weekday?
Yes.
Okay, the regular sitter here? Yes. Many times we use, thanks, we use words other than, we use all kinds of names of Hashem. The only time we don't use, the only name of Hashem we don't use for idolatry is the Yud Kei Vav Kei. That name, that's unassailable. That name can never be used for anything profane. But all the other names of Hashem, listen to this. Kikael Godel Hashem. Because Hashem is a great God. Umelech Godel, and he's a great king. I'll call over him on all the other gods. He's a great king over all the other gods. You hear that? How to translate in English? And a great king above all heavenly powers. You know, they're afraid to deal with it. You can't translate it. How do you, again, listen to the words. This is not my. Ki Kael Godel Hashem. Hashem, UK Vavke, is a great Kael. Great God. Umelach Godel, and he's a great king. Who's he a king over? I'll call over him. He's a great king over all the other gods. Other gods, it says clearly here. It doesn't say bits and pieces of wood that some South Sea Islanders have stuck together. It doesn't say that. Graven images. Or figments of the imagination, it says other gods. Did you ever think about this problem? You should have. And you took him, it says later that Yevoshu kol oivdei pesel, all people who serve idols will be ashamed. Hamis halalim balalim, who praise themselves or praise false gods. Hishtachavu loy kol Elohim. And all other gods will bow down to Hashem. Other gods, says openly. Look, you'll find many verses that talk about other gods as if they're very, very real. That those are inferior to Hashem. Hashem rules over them. They'll bow down to Hashem. The Torah is talking about other gods as if they exist. And that has to be understood. That's a problem. In the West, we try to think, the conventional Western idea that we Jews have brought up in Western culture, is that idolatry is a It's a pandering to a figment of the imagination. It's a complete unreal, complete unreality. There's only one reality, which is Hashem. Right? Most of us know we're supposed to think that at least. And here are these people who are idolaters, so they worship a figment of the imagination. They can't. Again, an intelligent 10-year-old knows that there can't be two absolutes. There can't be two absolutes. Right? When we say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, what we mean when we say one, we don't mean one and not two. You can't. Anybody understands anything about a higher reality knows that if you're dealing with an absolute, there must only be one. When we say Hashem Echad, what we mean is there's nothing else at all. Never mind any other God. There's nothing else at all. There's no me. There's no you. There's no up. There's no down. There's nothing. Only Hashem is all oneness. And of course, that's why you don't say the word too long. You say Echad, you don't prolong the word too long, because if you think about that too much, you can get a real mental and emotional problems, because coming to realization that you don't really exist at a higher level, which has to be discussed separately, that's a problematic thought. And so we just say it long enough to realize that everything really is Hashem and His manifestation, and then we come back to our normal selves. And we understand that there's an absolute power, and the Torah talks about others, other gods, as if they exist. If these other gods do exist, by the way, what are they exactly? Are they the South Sea Islanders rock carving, or this person who makes a totem pole where he carves out of wood various shapes? Is that what the Torah is talking about? Let's try and understand this very, very difficult subject. I have to understand something about astrology here in order to understand something about idolatry. Let's try and put it like this. This is very abstract and difficult stuff, very much based in the mystical sources. But if you stay with me, try to get at least, let's try and build together at least a picture. We should not strive here for an inner understanding of these things, because beyond a certain level we cannot have an inner understanding. We can only have what the mystics call a yodia. That means we can know how it is. A hasaga, which means to understand it, we can't have when we get to a certain level. But we can have some sort of vague concept of a picture. And without understanding what it means, because I assure you I don't understand what it means, the picture is like this. The picture, the words are as follows. While you hear these words, don't make a picture in your mind, by the way. Because if you picture it as a picture, so then you're already transgressing the prohibition that we're talking about tonight. If you make a picture about the things we're talking about, you're in trouble. So all you're allowed to do is hear a picture in terms only of an explanation. But you're not allowed to think to yourself that that picture has any intrinsic reality. The picture is something like this. The words are something like this. We know that the model we have of reality is that there are many, many levels of reality. Right? We're at the lowest end, generally speaking. There might be one level lower than us, which is the world of impurity, maybe, but for purposes of this discussion, we're at the lowest level of all the devolving rungs of reality. The highest being, of course, Hashem Himself, which we can't begin to understand, that name that we can never say. But between that reality, as it were, and between where we are, there are many levels that bring down that essence, right, Hashem's manifestation, into more and more concrete or more tangible or less abstract forms, until finally it crystallizes as this world. That's a basic Jewish idea, the Nefesh HaChaim, which is a work that's completely acceptable in the yeshiva world. It's not only very deep mystics to study that work. That work says quite openly that this is the way it works. There are many levels, each one lower than the one before, each one a translation of the level above it into the level below it. Whatever all this means, not for tonight. But nevertheless, that's what it is. But let's not focus on those levels that we can't understand. Let's say this. Finally, when those levels get close enough to this level, there's the last level before this one. That's the one we want to focus on this evening. Listen carefully. Stay with me. We have a level that we can't even begin to think about. We're not allowed to think about it. That becomes another level, which becomes another one, all the time condensing energy in some mystical way. Sooner or later, whenever it is, instantaneously as it happens, it gets down to what's called this world. This world of tangible, finite reality. This world down here is a projection of the energies of the higher world. Each one shining into a lower level, into a lower one, into a lower one. There's a level just before this one, which is the projector, right? The projector that shines into the reflection, which is this world. That level is called the stars. That's called the astrological world. That's called the zodiac. Right? That's called the zodiac. Let's get that clear. So let's do it like this, to simplify. There are many higher levels that we can't even think about. And there's a level that we can think about, this one. In between is a translation zone. That translation zone is the world of the stars. Fair enough? Yes? That's the meaning of an astrological phenomenon. That the higher energies that we can't grasp focus themselves into packages which are reflected by the stars. They're not the stars themselves, but the stars and their movements and their patterns and their organization reflect these energies. And that world of the stars, organized the way it is, projects its energy down into this world and makes this world happen. And makes things move in this world the way they move. Fair enough? You realize, of course, from this, that predictions based on astrology, which are certainly valid in Torah, the fact that you're not allowed to go to an astrologer, you may not seek astrological prediction. I'll try and explain why that is. But that doesn't invalidate the fact that astrological prediction certainly can be valid. The Torah is full of it. It says that we went out of Mitzrayim Paroi. Pharaoh saw by astrological prediction a certain thing that would happen, and he told Moshe Rabbeinu, he said it to the Jewish people. The Egyptian sorcerers were able to see astrological predictions. It says that Avraham Avinu himself saw that he would have no children, predicted astrologically. It's not a question that it's a valid skill. Who has it today, and who's only a charlatan, and who's genuine? That's another discussion, but that such a skill exists, there's no question about. What is the skill of astrology? What is it exactly? Well, if you think about it, all it is a reading of the forces as they are disposed at present before they manipulate or before they cause the events and phenomena that they cause when they reach here, when they strike bottom. Yes? In other words, strictly speaking, astrology is not reading the future. It's just reading the present. Again, reading the future is prophecy. That no astrologer can do. That we don't have anymore in this generation. But the Gemara is quite clear that prophecy does not exist anymore. The only place that prophecy exists now is in children, people who are insane, and dogs. That's what the Gemara says. Three places. The only place where you find elements of prophecy now. But aside from that, we don't have valid, usable prophecy anymore. But astrology we do. No reason why astrology can't. What is astrology? Astrology is not a privileged information from Hashem about what will be. Astrology is simply looking at the way things are now. Yes? The way the energies are coming down now, an astrologer can see. You don't see what's about to happen because you don't know how to look at those energies. Are you with me? But it's not. Let me give you an example. A marshal. An analogy. The way those energies are coming down, they are disposed in a certain way. If you know how to read them, you know what they'll do. Actually, it says you can never know specifically, you can only know in general because they can translate themselves in a number of ways. Let's leave that out for now. But basically, a person can see what's going to be. Why? Not because you see what is going to be, but because you see now. Analogy. Let's assume you take a seed of a tree. The seed is the root of the tree. If you project the seed into the future, it will grow a tree, correct? Yes? It doesn't look like a tree now. Astrology doesn't look like events. The way the stars are disposed, the way the astrological energies are disposed, right, in that world, they don't look like the events. But they model exactly those events, just like the seed models the tree. If you cut open a seed, take an acorn and cut it in half, and look inside, you don't find a little oak tree. A child might think that if you cut an acorn in half, you'd find a little oak tree. And then what happens is it gets bigger. But that's not the way it is. When you cut open an oak tree, all you find is a white gelatinous material. You want to see that that's an oak tree, you have to know seeds. But if you know seeds, if you take that seed to a man who knows seeds, and you show him the seed, he'll tell you that's going to be an oak tree. The man's not reading the future. He's reading the present. He doesn't see the future, he sees the present, but he knows seeds. Are we together? An astrologer is not reading the future. An astrologer knows seeds, that's all. A geneticist, you want to put it into modern terms, a geneticist. So you give him a cell of your body, yes? You scrape a cell out of the inside of your mouth, and you give it to a geneticist. And he'll tell you, right? Or you could take a cell from the fetus, or from the liquid surrounding the fetus, and he could tell you the child's going to have blue eyes. He doesn't look through his microscope or his genetic things and see blue. That's not the way it works. He sees genes. You have to know how to read genes. Genes don't look like eyes. They don't look like the shape of your nose, the shape of your ears, etc. But they are an exact parallel. They are what codes for what will be later. Not reading the future. Relative to you is reading the future because you don't know how to read genes. Are you with me? An astrologer is somebody who simply knows how to read the energies the way they are now. He can't read higher than that because higher than those energies are not amenable to human sight, to human insight. You can only see them from where they, above the ceiling as it were, above the ceiling, the way those energies are disposed are not accessible to our vision. We can't see them. But there comes a time when they dispose themselves into the way that they need to be for what happens here, and at that point, if you know how to read it, you can see them. Just like reading genes, reading seeds, that's what it is. Why is it, if you want the technical, if you're interested in the spiritual world, the mystical world, why is it that astrologers can see what will be by looking at that level, Here the mystics explain very, very fascinatingly that the reason is because... Oh, this is... I shouldn't talk too much about these things, but in honor of Sukkot, maybe. See, the mystics say that at a higher level, I'm just going to say the words, don't ask any questions. But at a higher level than that intermediate zone, you're looking inside the head. You can't see inside the head. All you can see is what comes out of the head. What comes out of the head, inside the head everything is one. Outside of the head, everything begins to break down into its packets of energy, where each one has its own individual channel. Once the channels are finite, once the channels are defined, once each package or channel is a finite package, and it's not in the world where everything's all one, so then you could already begin to identify what each package is going to do. It hasn't done it yet, but that's no problem. The mystics say that that's the secret of the hair. Hair grows on the head, because hair is a... Each hair is a package of what's contained inside in a finite way. Inside, the brain is all one. That's all your thoughts, your consciousness of yourself are one. But as the head manifests on the outside, hair comes out in individual packages. That's why the mystics say that these channels that bring down energies from the higher world, they're called sinorot. Sinorot, they're called pipelines. The pipelines, the channels, the pipes that pour down the energy from the higher world, they come down from that intermediate world in pipelines. Above that, they come down in one massive channel that we can't begin to discern. But from here, we can talk about it, but we can't discern them. But a skilled astrologer can look up to where the channels become finite, and he can identify them. Once you can identify individual pipelines, individual hairs, so then you can already be talking in a finite world. The word hair in Hebrew, by the way, se'ar, the root is shiur, which means a finite package, a finite defined amount. Right? A finite amount. The word mispar in Hebrew, which means a number, an individual number, same root as tispor, it means a haircut in Hebrew. Because then you're making finite to finite. Right? That's what it is. Sfar, the word mispar means finite. Sfar means a border, an edge. Char, a gate. Shiur. And se'ar, and sha'ar, a gateway. What's a gateway? It's a limited opening that only a finite amount can go through at once, right? Only a certain number of people can go through that gateway at once, a certain number of animals, whatever it is. Sha'ar, that's what it is. Anyway, Kali said too much already. So. That's, by the way, why, once you're on the subject, that's very deeply connected to why married women have to cover their hair. Because the energy pulsating out where the hairs appear is so powerful when a woman reaches the state of marriage that it allows you to see internal and intimate things that shouldn't be seen. By the way, men are capable of that too, but men are not on the same spiritual level as women, and men only pulsate out that energy when they marry and meditate, which is why when you daven Shmoneh Esrei, you cover your hair with a tzitzit. Right? That's why the Ashkenazi custom is only married men do that. It's only necessary for married men. Tzaddikim are more sensitive, they're more sensitive. I'm not talking about some of these things, but anyway, now we definitely said too much. Now, let's get back to the subject. At any rate, we're dealing with where the energies become finite. Once they become finite, even though they may be more refined than the coarse, crude physical eyes can see, but nevertheless, once they're in the finite zone, pouring down the individual specific packets of energy, so then an astrologer can see them. What does all this have to do? That's astrology. So what's astrology? Astrology is a person looks up, and the person looks up at the way the energies are disposed by reading the way they manifest in that intermediate zone, which is called the zodiac. The word mazal, by the way, just to understand, just to kind of hear this sensitively. Zodiac in Hebrew is called mazal. Mazal. Mazal is the world of the mazalois are the signs of the zodiac. The 12 signs of the zodiac, the 12 month signs in Hebrew are called the mazalois. Mazal means literally to flow down. You know that? In Hebrew, nozel is a liquid. A flow of liquid, because it's a flowing down from a higher world of an energy that's seeping or flowing into this world. That's what it means. The real translation of mazal means a higher energy flowing down into this, so that this world is defined by a higher source. When you say mazal tov to somebody, when we say mazal tov, what do we mean by mazal tov? We mean that you should have auspicious energies, right? That you should be connected to the higher world in a way that starts you off at that the energy should be disposed in such a way that makes it easier. That you start at a higher point. But of course, like all Torah ideas, right, we have been taught to think of them in the opposite of their spiritual meaning. And we've been brought up to think that mazel is luck, which is exactly the opposite of that which has a higher source, isn't it? Isn't it? What is luck? The English, it's exactly coincidence. Mazel. Luck in English means that which has no higher source. Good luck in English means, you know, that's the coincidence, you know, the wheel should start spinning at the right place. It should happen that way. Can you hear that? When we say Mazel Tov to somebody, we are wishing a very pagan wish when we don't understand this. When we, again, if you translate the word Mazel not as zodiac energy, but as coincidental luck element, so what you're doing is you're twisting Torah exactly to the opposite of what it should be. Are you with me? Yes? In English, the translation of luck means that which is not connected to any transcendent source and not determined by any higher energy. Exactly the opposite of what the Torah means. There couldn't be anything more profane, more idolatrous than saying good luck to somebody. It means there's a lot of coincidence and yours should just fall out correctly. That's exactly what we don't need. The energies are very powerful. The Gemara says a child born at a certain time. If a child born on a certain day of the week or a certain time. So, as that energy forms the world, so that when a child being formed, appearing, manifesting in the world, so they have energies that are determined by that force and they can never change it. Never change it. The Gemara says a child could be born at such a constellation, such a confluence of constellations that the child could be born bloodthirsty. Bloodthirsty. The Gemara says a child could be born in such a way that the child cannot change the fact that he's bloodthirsty. So the Gemara says, well, what should he do about it? The Gemara says, what's the problem? Let him be a shechet or a moel or a surgeon or such. What's the problem? Yes? Use it for a kosher purpose. No problem. But that. Yeah. What's this got to do with idolatry? So let's understand. A person looks at the energies and he reads the signs and he sees what's going to happen. Anything wrong with that? Nothing wrong with it. It says that the great people of ancient history, the great Jewish Abraham, Avraham Avinu, was able to do that. He was able to do that. What's wrong with it? Listen well. What's wrong with it is, if you look up to that source where the energy is flowing down and you don't look any further, that's what's wrong with it. When you confuse that for the source, that's a false god. Listen well. A false god in Torah is not a figment of the imagination that some problematic psychotic thought up. That's not a false god. That's nonsense. That falls under Torah's prohibition of doing things that are stupid. Right? And there's a definite prohibition of the Torah to do that which is silly. Right? A person who carves a shape in a piece of wood and thinks that it's his god, okay, that person's transgressed the prohibition of being ridiculous long before he's transgressed the prohibition of idolatry. Are you with me? Before that person needs to do tshuva, that person needs, you know, psychiatric therapy before he... Are we together? We're not talking about that. We're not talking about a person who goes to a figment of his imagination. That's mamash nebuch, a pathetic situation. We're talking about a person who focuses on reality. That's who we're talking about as an idolater. He knows exactly where it's coming from. And he looks up to the channel that's delivering it exactly. But he doesn't look beyond the channel. That's his problem. He looks to that source which is a valid source. And of course it has the same names as Hashem's name. Because it's the same channel. It's the end result. Are you with me? Well, again, when you want to look up to Hashem for what's pouring down towards you from Him, there's no other place to look. You have to look into the channel. You look into the end of the pipeline. But if you look into the end of the pipeline hoping to look through it, up to the source, that's looking to the real name of Hashem. But if you look to the opening of the pipeline and you don't look any further, you only look to what manifests for you, you're looking at the right place. And that's why the same names can be... And you're looking at reality. That's why the Torah can talk about these energies as if they are real things, because they are real. Are we together? But the problem is, you should be perceiving beyond it to the ineffable source that's beyond it that can never be perceived. That's the work of spirituality. Not to just look to what's perceivable and cut it off from its source. Idolatry means looking up to that place, cutting it off, and being interested only in where it starts to manifest and come down, and not bothering what's beyond that. That's called idolatry. Why is that so? What does it mean? What it means is this. The great Rav Wasserman. There's pictures on the wall over there. Come here and teach us. He put it this way. He said, why does an idolater do what he does? A person who worships an idol, he looks up to these channels. By the way, you realize immediately that graven images are just physical reflections of these energies. They're just physical reflections. They're just physical depictions of a higher energy. The person is not worshipping his piece of wood, but he's graven himself an image. He's carved himself an image so that he can focus on what this force of nature is. What are these channels exactly? They're the forces of nature, aren't they? Why do you think they worship the sun? Isn't the sun part of the zodiac system that brings down energy? Isn't the sun what does everything here? And the way it does it determines what happens? Isn't that part of the system? As part of many other energies? This person worships the sun because he knows correctly that energy comes down to him and his fortune depends on how it comes down to him from there. He makes a picture of it only because once he's already holding in the finite, once he's already holding in the world of the finite, so there's only a small step from there to make an actual picture of the thing in finite physical terms as well. But the person has more intelligence than to actually think that it is drawing or his carving that does it. By the way, you should know, I'll try and explain why almost all idolatrous images are human. Why they always have a human representation. Actually, because what's being worshipped is the self. I'll explain that. Why does a person look up to the channels and not look beyond? Sir Rav Hoffman used to say this. Listen carefully, it's the most brilliant explanation. That somebody with no background, you don't need any Torah for this, you need no Gemara learning, you just hear this explanation, it's brilliant in its clarity. He used to say like this. Idolatry is, this is what he said. He said, idolatry is a man who walks into a department store and he wants a camera behind the counter. The camera costs $1,500 and he only has $150. So he calls over the assistant behind the counter and he says, look, I'll give you $150, you slip me the camera. That's idolatry. What does it mean? What it means is this. When you walk into a department store, the price that you pay for the goods is because the owner of the store, right, his give and take works in such a way that you pay the price, he makes the profit. The assistant behind the counter, he's got nothing to do with where the funds go. He's just delivering the goods on an immediate basis. Right? But if you can bribe him, if you can pay him off, you can get the goods. Why are you doing that? Because you only care about who delivers the goods. You don't care. This man who walks into the department store and pays off the clerk, the assistant pays him $150, all he wants is the man who delivers it. I don't interest in who runs the store. It has an interest, nothing to do with me. I don't care who runs the overall business, whether he's winning or losing. It has nothing to do with me. I'm interested in the man who delivers the goods. I want the camera. Who's the man who delivers? This guy delivers the goods. He sells. I'll pay him off. Isn't that what idolatry is? Idolatry is, who delivers the goods up there? Yes? Where is the source of love, of wealth, of fertility, of war, yes, of success? Where's the individual package source? So I'll go to that source. I'll pay it off. Idolatry involves a price, sacrifice, and no question. But the real price. See, the real price is all you have. The real price that's exacted by the owner of the store, that's all you have. Every minute of the rest of your life, that's what's demanded. That's what Avodat Hashem is. Avodat Hashem means making yourself subservient to the source of reality, every single fiber of your being for every single minute of the rest of your life, and beyond that, forever. Oh, that's a bit heavy. That's a bit heavy. No? I'm not ready for that. So I'll pay something. I'll pay what the assistant behind the counter needs to slip me the goods. Because I'm interested in getting... Are we together, gentlemen? So that's idolatry. So idolatry looks on the focused energies, what delivers this, what delivers that, what, and he relates to it. And he worships it, and he serves it, and he pays off bribes to it, because he wants the goods. You know, if you look, for example, at the gods of Greece, the Greek gods, Greece was a society that was very self-oriented and very physical. Greece was not a spiritual society. The highest level of transcendence in Greece was aesthetics, which is part of the physical as well. But Greece had gods. Greece had plenty of gods. Greece had gods of everything. But they didn't have one. If you look in that whole pantheon of Greek gods up there on the mount, whatever it is, if you look at them, and you study them, you'll find there's a god of love and a god of war and a god of this and a god of that. But there's not one who created the world. They don't have one who created the world. Why? Because that's irrelevant. Yes, that's irrelevant. Who cares about him? See, in delivery of the goods, that's irrelevant to him. And therefore, a person who's the worshipper of Hashem, Avodas Hashem means, never mind the goods. Where's the source? And he goes to the source. A person who's interested in idolatry looks at the sources that deliver the goods because he's interested in the goods being delivered. If you think about it for 1 minute, you'll realize that the real difference between the two of them, the real difference between the two of them, is that the person who's interested in the source is interested in Hashem himself. Not me. Like, what can I do for him? But the person who's interested in delivering the goods is interested in me. The man who wants the goods, what he really cares about is me. That's the difference. These are opposite poles of reality. The person that's interested in Avodas Hashem means, what can I do for him? What is he? He's the boss. What does he say I have to do? What's my service involved? Whether it will benefit me or not is irrelevant. I do what he wants. But the idolater's God is really him. And all he wants is, he'll go beyond himself only to the source of delivery of each individual. That's what, I'm what counts. You know, it says that, Tzadikim, Elokeim, Oimdim Aleim. It says that the righteous people, their God stands over them. Like it says, Hashem Nitzav Olav. Yaakov was dreaming, and he dreamt about a ladder, and Hashem was standing over it. And it says, Hashem was standing over him. The tzaddik is on the bottom, Hashem stands over him. But the idolaters, it says, Haim Oimdim Al Elohim. They stand over their gods. Like it says that Paro, Pharaoh, Omed Alayor, he was standing over the Nile. The Nile was the Egyptian god. The Nile was the Egyptian deity. And Paro was standing over the river. You understand? The true worshipper of Hashem says, Hashem, you tell me what to do. The idolater says to his god, I'll tell you what I need. You do what I say. Right? Why was the Nile the god of Egypt? Because that's where the bounty came from. The Nile overflowed and made Egypt fertile. So that's the end. That's what counts. What counts is our wealth. Me. You want to put it in very sharply, understand, that the worship of Hashem, that the real true worship of Hashem, is that I sacrifice everything that's most precious to me, including myself, entirely to Hashem. Idolatry means that I expect Him to sacrifice everything for me. I don't want to say too much, I'll just say a hint, because this can get us into trouble. But just listen carefully, I'll just say the minimum. That's why Judaism begins, Torah begins with a man sacrificing his son for Hashem. And our arch enemy in the world begins with God sacrificing his son. There's the difference. And let's go a little further with this principle and see where it takes us. And Rambam says this, how did idolatry begin? See, it's so clear when you understand this principle. Rambam says idolatry began like this. In the beginning, people were worshippers of Hashem. People knew the reality. Adam Arishon, Adam, taught his children the reality. Noah, when he came out of the ark. Right? He still had a direct connection with Hashem. There was prophecy in those days. And they related to Hashem directly. Then, says the Rambam, unbelievable thing. The Rambam says that people of the early generations, they saw that everything came from Hashem. And then they said to themselves, but Hashem operates with us through intermediaries. He doesn't relate directly to us. We don't see His hand come down directly. What He does is He animates nature in such a way that the forces of nature bring about cause and effect in the world. And if Hashem uses the forces of nature like the wind and the rain and the sun and the stars, etc., then is it not fitting to pay honor to his emissaries? If a king sends you an honored messenger, he sends you his prime minister to your home. Don't you honor the prime minister of the king, his cabinet minister? You honor the minister as a representative of the king? Sure you do. Therefore, since Hashem uses the sun and the forces of nature to energize the world, to represent and reflect him in the world, is it not fitting for us to pay honor to those things as emissaries of the king? So they started worshipping, listen carefully, they started showing honor and doing obeisance to the intermediaries as agents of Hashem. And then says the Rambam, after a while they forgot about Hashem. And they were left with the agencies only. Now what occasioned that forgetting? They just conveniently forgot? Just happened to forget? Obviously what happened was, originally the reality was clear. But after a while they began to say to themselves, hey, you know, who cares about the source? The intermediaries deliver the goods. The vested interest, the lower self, interested only in me and where the goods come from to supply me with my needs. And I forgot about the source. They didn't forget, they cut off the source. That's idolatry. What we've learned this evening so far, is that the difference between Avodas Hashem and idolatry is this. They look to the same direction exactly. They both perceive reality. They both see the channels bringing down energy. They both read the energies the same. They're not psychotic, ridiculous behavior. This is witnessing exactly where things come from. The difference is that the Eved Hashem goes all the way to the source and he says, Hashem, you're doing this for me. What does it obligate me to do for you? And the Eved Avodah Zorah, the idolater, looks to the source. He looks in the direction of the source. He goes as high as he needs to go to see where things affect him, and that's all he's interested in. But it's accurate. He's not wrong. It's a much more subtle error than that. Much more dangerous and much more subtle error. Actually, the most potent way you can probably put it is that in many sources it says, mystical sources, it says that, I just wrote a book about this actually. A book came out a couple of weeks ago. I try to put a lot of this down in many different ways. One chapter that tries to put this together, if you want to research it more, you could look it up over there. You'll see a beautiful idea that the difference between looking all the way to the source is looking at purity, and looking only at the bottom level is looking at that which should be excreted. Again, that which should be excreted is an essential part of wholesome food when it's taken together with wholesome food. But when you look at it only on its own, it's disgusting. Yes? Again, the mystics say that absorbing reality means like eating food. When you eat food, you have a combination of the pure and the impure, and that's nourishing to the body. When the body's taking what's nourishing, what's left is objectionable, is offensive and objectionable, smells terrible, is a very, very disgusting and lowly entity in the world. That's what it is. Avodah Zorah Idolatry is taking only the remainders. It's taking only the finite lower end of reality, chopping it off from its nourishing source, and what you're left with is excrement. And that's why idolatry in the world is called avodas gilulim, worship of dung balls. You know that? Dung, excrement. The Hebrew word, the Torah word for idolatry is worship of excrement. That's what it's called. If you think about it further, you'll see how obvious it is. What happened in the desert when the Jewish people were going through the desert? Yes? What were, again, listen well to this. What were they eating in the desert? Manna, man. What was unique about the manna? There was no excrement. You know that? When you ate manna, when they lived at that level, which was completely in the higher world, there was no excrement at all in the body. The body had not, because it was only the purity of food that was absorbed without. And what was their arch rival spiritually in the desert? Peor. What was the cult of Peor? You know what the idolatrous cult of Peor was in the desert? You know what it was? The cult that swept the world at the time. The idolatry that was that was uppermost in the world's, yes, the world's lexicon of idolatrous practices was a practice called Peor. It was the worship of excretion and excrement. That's what it was. The way they worshipped those people, they came up to their idol and they performed their ablutions, right, in front of the idol. That was how you worshipped it. Again, are we talking about raving psychotics? Is that the Torah talking about? The Torah enshrines, yes? In Torah, we're talking about Torah here, not annals of the, you know, you understand? We're not dealing here with the history of Meshugoyim. That's not, we're dealing with the annals of Torah. That means the Jewish people were in counterpoise to a people that just as we worshipped, and it's hard to say the words, just as we worshipped Hashem, they worshipped excretion and excrement. They weren't psychotic at all. They knew exactly what they were doing. The statement they were making was exactly this. The Gemara says that there was a woman in those days, just so you understand it. The Gemara says there was a woman who had worshipped all the idolatries in the world. And then she found, and when she came to Peor, when she heard about this one, she was so disgusted that she'd done everything, this lady. She'd done everything. Every idolatrous practice she had done. When she heard about this, she was so disgusted, she decided to show her disgust for it. So she went up, and instead of performing what she had to perform in front of the idol, she did it on top of the idol. Yeah? So it says the priests of Peor came up to her and congratulated her. They'd never seen such consummate worship in the world. Okay? Because that's exactly the point. Exactly the point. Exactly the point. The Gemara says that a person, there was a certain person who started a system in the world of idolatrous worship. The Gemara says in the next world his punishment is that he's being boiled in boiling excrement. That's his punishment. His punishment in the next world is that he's being boiled in excrement. What a punishment? What a punishment is that? The reason is because he started a movement in the world of idolatry. Idolatry is separating food, the food of the world, into the manna component and relating only to the excreted component. So that's his punishment in the next world. Anyway, these things are, they all fit together. That's what it is. Let's add one detail and see if we can come back to what we said. Avram Avinu. So Avram looks at the stars. Now let's understand the central point that we have to know about astrology and about these things. It should be obvious at this point that the work of a Jew is to look up to the channels, no problem with that, but to look beyond. If you look up there and you stop there, that's idolatry. Better not to look. If you're going to look and you're going to stop there, so then you're making excrement out of that, the holiest thing that there could be. That's exactly what you do. The work of a Jew is to look there, but go all the way. Don't stop there. Jewish chutzpah is designed for going straight to the boss. We don't deal with intermediaries. Isn't that what a Jew does? That's what a Jew does. We don't deal with the intermediaries. We go to the boss and demand it for 150. Isn't that the way it is? We've got the right to do that. That's what Jewish chutzpah is. We stand up and speak to the boss directly and ask for what we need. What? I saw a cartoon recently. It was captioned "The Height of Chutzpah." It was a man walking into a bookstore, and he says to the assistant behind the counter, "I want to buy a book on chutzpah, and I want you to pay." Anyway. Straight to the source and not being involved. That's why we don't speak to intermediaries. We're not allowed to speak to angels. We're not allowed to speak to angels. Or spiritual, even valid ones, that are doing Hashem's will, we're not allowed to speak to. We don't dive into graves. We don't dive into the dead. We don't pray. Yes? We use the merit of great tzaddikim to help us. But we don't pray to anybody who's dead or to any saints or angels or forces. That's idolatrous. And we're not allowed to speak to anything other than the source. As opposed to many other systems, of course, that speak explicitly to the intermediates. So Abraham looks up and he says to Hashem, listen to this. Hashem says, you hear already the prohibition of astrology. knowing what the energies are, that's fine. But worshipping, that means accepting those sources, looking to those sources, they're not beyond. Yes, but Abraham says to Hashem, God says to him, you'll have a son. So Avraham Avinu says, but Hashem, it says in the stars that I won't have a son. Listen to this crazy, listen to this discussion. God appears to Abraham in prophecy. And he says, Avraham, you're going to have a son. And he'll be the founder of the Jewish people. So Avraham, instead of saying thanks, that's wonderful, he says, Hashem, it says in the stars that I won't, because I see that Tzedek, whichever planet is over here, it should be over. I see from the way the stars are that I will not have a son. So Hashem says, no, you will have a son. So he says, no, I see in the stars that it's... And then it says, Vayet Oysel, because Hashem took him outside. The simple meaning, he took him out of his tent, and he showed him the stars, and he said, as numerous as the stars will be your descendants. But the mystics say, he didn't take him out of his tent, he took him outside the stars. And he said, you're not subject to those. Listen carefully. What argument is this exactly? Hashem says, you'll have a son. He says, Hashem, it says in the stars otherwise. You know, who's the boss here? Who's the boss? God is speaking to you directly. Hashem appears to Abraham and says, you'll have a son. So he says, Hashem, thanks, but the stars say otherwise. But obviously the discussion is this. Hashem says, you'll have a son. That's a word of Hashem. So Abraham says, Hashem, but you wrote the stars. They are your word. The stars, the way they're disposed, are also your speaking to me. You know the problem? The stars are valid. They're the interface between your world and ours, as I tried to explain before. So when you tell me I'll have a son, your word is telling me that I'll have a son. But the stars, which are your word too, they're your handwriting, they say I won't. So he wasn't arguing with God, he was saying you're contradicting yourself. Yes, you're telling me a contradiction, which is true. So Hashem said to him, you're quite right, the stars say you won't. But you beyond the stars. And he took him outside. You're quite right, the stars say you won't have a son. But the Jewish people are beyond the stars. The stars dance to your tune, not the other way around. Then he learned the great secret, that no matter how the energies are disposed, right, if you make yourself subservient to them and you say, but they say this, you know what the punishment is? You can't get out of it. Do you know what the punishment for astrology is? The Gemara says that the punishment for astrology is that if you go to an astrologer, it becomes inevitable. Whatever the astrologer tells you, those energies are there. Because you put yourself into that system, you've made yourself subservient to the finite, you're part of the finite. And those forces, when they strike bottom, they strike you. Whichever way they're disposed, it's inevitable. You know what's going to happen now, but you can't change it. And the correct attitude for a Jew is to say, whichever way the energies are, I go beyond that, and they'll change according to my needs. You hear that? We're not the result of the energies, we're the cause. Actually, the mystical sources say that there's no contradiction, because the way the energies are actually could strike bottom in more than one way. And if you become subservient to them in a forbidden way, they strike ground in one way. But if you transcend yourself to be the source of them, those same energies, looked at, let's say, from the mirror image reflection, they turn out to be something else. This is another discussion in its own right. For those who are interested, I'll just say a word about it. For example, it says that we were destined to be slaves for 410 years. Right? For 400, whatever, 400. Yes? 400 years, slaves in we would be saved. On that, when we were slaves, we were only there for 210 years. So, you know, the Torah itself said, predicts Hashem himself, the Torah itself says 400 years. So now, you calculated wrong. Before Hashem said, means he was going to, Hashem saw that we couldn't stand the 400 years, so he recalculated from the birth of Yitzchak. What does it mean? What does it mean? It wasn't 210, it was 400, but you don't know where it came from. Again, it means that the predictions are true, but you have to not understand them. And if you transcend into the root, what happens is they become valid in another way. Not invalid. You don't wipe out the system. Nature's nature, takes its course. But it has another way of operating that was hidden to you before, that's now revealed. Are you with me? What you read a week ago. It says that the Sfas Emes says, beautiful thing, when Hagar was sitting in the desert watching her son die at first. So it says, Hashem opened her eyes and she saw the well. He made a miracle, right? A nice. There was a well of water and she fed her, she gave her son water to drink from the well. So it says, Hashem opened her eyes and, so the Sfas Emes says, it does not say Hashem created a well miraculously. It simply says Hashem opened her eyes. Meaning, the thing's there already, you just have to see it. The level that's needed in the world is always there, never has to be made. The thing is, are you going to see it or not? That's the only thing. And people of spiritual depth know that it's only a question of, no matter what the prediction is, no matter what the prediction is, you don't have to worry about that. No matter what the stars say, you don't have to worry about it. If you're a Jew, you can disregard that entirely. If you don't disregard it, it's inevitable. If you go to an astrologer, you're locked in. But if someone tells you, you know what it says in Halacha? If an astrologer walks up to you and says, tomorrow this and this is going to happen to you, you're allowed to believe it. You're allowed to believe it. If it's an accredited astrologer who's got a track record of success, somebody who's accredited and valid, and that person tells you, I see for you this and this and this, you don't have to laugh it off. And you can take action to avert it. You're allowed to believe it. But you may not inquire about the information. Because if you go there and say, what's going to be, you're putting yourself, you're locking yourself in. And if you lock yourself in, you're locked in. But if you hold yourself not to be locked in, you hold yourself to be above it. So then you're above it. And what's predicted is irrelevant. And there was a Hasidic Rebbe davening on Shabbos. The Rebbe was davening for hours and hours for the Mashiach. Hashem should send the Mashiach now. So in the middle of the, it's a long davening, the Hasidim came up and said, Rebbe, you know it says in the Gemara the Mashiach can't come on Shabbos. The Gemara says the Mashiach cannot come on Shabbos. And here you're standing here on Shabbos in flagrant contradiction to the Gemara, and you're saying Hashem send the Mashiach now. You understand? It's a kasha. So he answered them, let him come now, there'll be a kasha. You understand? So there'll be a problem. So they'll have a difficulty, but let him come. But the meaning, you see, it's not a humorous story. The meaning of it is that when he comes, you'll realize, well, it's not a problem. You understand? Now the energies look a certain way. In your narrow vision with closed eyes, it looks like this. But after you lift yourself into the transcendent root, you see it wasn't like that. And it'll still be true. You understand what it meant really afterwards? It was 400 years. A calculated wrong. Of course, if you want to merit to be in this, in the root dimension, so you have to get there. You have to get there. You don't get it for nothing. Okay? Avram Avinu says to Hashem, the stars say this, and Hashem says, you belong outside the stars. Why did Hashem lift him outside the stars? Hashem took him out of the natural order. He took him out of all those energies, and he put him in the root dimension. You know why? Because he dared to live there. He dared to live in that dimension. When Hashem said, kill your son, yes, but he didn't say, oh, Hashem, that's impossible. He didn't deal with what's possible and impossible. He just did. He transcended human nature to raise himself. When the rest of the world was involved in what? In idolatry, what did he do? He related to Hashem directly. You do that, he lifts you up there. Are you with me? You walk into the department store and you brush aside the clerk behind the counter. And you walk straight to the manager's office. So the manager deals with you. In Israel, that's standard. I mean, it's not... In Israel, that's what's expected. Lots more to say, but let's just come back to this and we'll leave it there for this evening. So we say like this, on Sukkot when we come close to Hashem, that's the time of all idolatries falling away. Being subservient to the system, that's what we've cleansed out of us on Yom Kippur. That's what we've hoped to transcend on Yom Kippur. We reach the level where we see things clearly. So then we come on Sukkot and we say like this, Hashem, our forefathers stood in this place and they worshipped the sun. They were idolaters. They worshipped the intermediate levels. But we, listen to this, Achoreim al-Eichel, their backs, listen to this beautiful expression. What does Achorai mean, the back? You know what the back is, the mystics say? The side of excretion. That's what it is. The back is always the side of excretion. Do you know what? You know in some mystical commentaries it says that Elohim Acherim, listen carefully, Elohim Acherim, which is translated as other gods, in some mystical sources it says it really should be Elohim Achoraim, the back side. Yes, the gods, you understand? The Acherim, which means other, can also mean achor, the back of. Yes? Means the excrement element. That's what it is. So their backs were to the sanctuary. You hear what's going on? And their faces were to the east. And they were bowing down to the east, to the sun. And they were saying, yeah, they were worshipping the sun. But Anu Lekainenu, our eyes are to Hashem. We're not like that. We see the light. We understand what it should be. And we worship you, Hashem. What's your Yehuda answer? Beautiful, this is Rav Wasserman said and made such an impression on me. Beautiful, beautiful. I mean, I thought he said this and now we have to understand Shati was Mishnah. He said like, Yehuda Omer, Hashem, they didn't say it like that. They used to say, Anu Leka, we are for Hashem. We look and our eyes are to Hashem. You know what this means? Beautiful, beautiful thing. The Yehuda used to say like this. The Chachamim said that our forefathers, the words were, our forefathers were idolaters. But we are Hashem, our eyes are to you. Said Rabbi Yehuda, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. You know why? Because of this. You know, an idolater turns his eyes to the channels. Why? Because he wants the goods. So what are you saying? You're saying that our eyes are to Hashem, right? Not to the false channels, and not to the intermediates. Our eyes are to Hashem directly. That's nice. But you know what's wrong with it? Because you know what you could be saying? That your eyes are to Hashem, you know what for? For the goods. For the goods. You know, Baruch Hashem, you're looking to the right source. But your motivation's you. You know, you can be a groupie in Torah. Yes, you can be a cultist or a groupie or a... In Torah, just like you can... If you're going to be a groupie or a cultist or whatever, you know, do it in Torah. Okay? Or rather, be attached to the correct source in the wrong way than the wrong source. But you can be connected to the, you can be connected. The easiest thing in Torah is to be connected to Hashem, but not for Him, for you. Are we together? When you're davening and you say, Hashem, I need this and this and this, and you, yes? I need health and wealth and wisdom and this and this. And, yeah. Well, 1 second, who do you need it for? For you? It's not about Hashem, that's about you. It's, the Nefesh Chaim says, when you daven to Hashem and you say, Hashem, I want health and wealth and wisdom, you don't mean for you, you mean for Him. You mean you want it so you can serve Him, not for you. What a chutzpah. You want it for you? You want wealth because you want to be rich. You got the chutzpah to stand there and tell Him you want that for you? That's, prayer is a service, isn't it? Service of Hashem. You're getting out there to serve your Creator. And how do you serve Him? With a shopping list? I want this and this and this and do it all for me. What a chutzpah. Says the Nefesh Chaim, that's not what you're asking. What you're asking is, Hashem, in order to serve you, I need the tools. Give me the tools for you, not for me. But there's a point of confusion there. So the Chachamim say that our forefathers worshipped the incorrect sources. And we, our eyes are to Hashem. Says Rabbi Yehuda, that's not good enough. Because a person could make a mistake here and turn his eyes to Hashem, but still only for his own interest. And that's why he added the words. He used to say, Anu Makar, we are for you, Hashem. And then Anu Makar Enenu. Then we turn our eyes to you. Our eyes are to you for delivery of the goods. That's fine. But we only dare say that after we say unconditionally that we are for you. You hear that? So Rabbi Huda adds these words in order that there should be no mistake at all. What we say is our forefathers were idolaters. They looked to these intermediate sources for their needs. And what we do is we say, Anu Lekha, we Hashem are for you. Let's get that clear. We're here for you. We serve you. No expectations. Now, after we've got that established, now we'll ask you for it. Those are the two parts. The message here is that this is included in the Gemara Sukkah, because Sukkah is a time of incredible closeness. The ecstasy of that worship in the Beis HaMikdash was a time of Hashem. The Beis HaMikdash is the place in the world where heaven and earth kiss. It's exactly the place of interface. It says the place, the Shemaya V'ara Nashke Adadi, heaven and earth kiss each other over there. That's what it means. The higher world meets the lower world. Exactly the point of interface. In another sense that we've been discussing this evening, that's where the temple stands. The Beis HaMikdash. And that's what was happening on Simchas Torah. The ecstasy was being able to touch that interface. That was being able to come to that point, cleanse from Yom Kippur, enter that zone of Kedusha, and relate directly to Hashem. And that's the point that a person has to clarify. You have to go into that sukkah, seeing Hashem only. That's, by the way, why we go into a sukkah. In your house, you can't see it. Because your house serves you. The thicker the walls and the thicker the roof, yeah, the thicker your wallet, the thicker the wall is between you and Hashem. But when you move into a sukkah so thin and flimsy, that you realize that it's not anything else over here, yet it's only Hashem. That's why the word sukkah is based on sacha. Sacha means to be able to see through. You see through that to see Hashem. You use the intermediates, the home that you live in, yes? You use it to be able to perceive and see through. Therefore, this sukkah is to be able to move into a sukkah and be able to perceive the root.